From Michigan Radio, this is Living with Cancer. I'm Rebecca Williams. There's been so much cancer among Karen Hawk's relatives that she calls it the family disease. It's been following her around for over 40 years. Her dad died from leukemia in the 60s, and she was diagnosed with lymphoma twice. The first time in seminary school, then again 23 years later.
My dad had leukemia in 1960. And it was at a time when there was very little they could do for that. Now, my dad wanted to know about it. My mom didn't want to talk about it, but he did. In fact, she didn't even want to tell him that he had cancer. In those days, patients would get diagnoses and nobody would tell them what it was. My grandmother, my mother's mother, got cancer the next summer, and my mother never told her. Never. My family likes to be quiet about things, you see, and not talk about them. And I couldn't, I just couldn't respond that way. I was diagnosed in 1981 with, my dad had leukemia. I had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. They did a regimen called MOP therapy, which is a combination of four different drugs. And one time when the first nurse did it, she put it in my arm, and it was so toxic, it ate the vein as it went up. It turned it black. There was a big black line on my arm. It was very painful. The treatment made me really sick, nauseated and such. So I was really angry. First of all, I was in seminary, and so what is this? God's calling me to seminary, and then I'm getting cancer? I don't get this. When they finally say that you're in remission, and that's what they say, they don't say you're cured. They say you're in remission and you need to be monitored for 5 years. And I guess then they said, you know, you're cured. So that was when I was in Boston, and I moved to Middletown, Ohio, and they found it. Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So the treatment was very similar, but in the 23 years that intervened, they had learned a lot more. You know, the support was so powerful. I had letters from people all over the world because I had classmates in seminary who had disseminated all over the world, and they heard. And I know the doctors do part of it, but they don't do all of it. That healing is as much a spiritual and social thing as it is a medical thing.
Karen Hawk's cancer is in remission. The experience of being a cancer patient doesn't end in the hospital. Treatments can go on for months or years, and cancer has a way of getting into every corner of our lives, not just our bodies. The way we respond to cancer's presence in our culture has changed a lot over time. Dr. Dean Brenner joins us again to talk about some of those changes and about some of the things we still don't know about how cancer works. Dr. Brenner, how has the way that we talk about cancer changed in the last 40 or 50 years?
Well, when I started in the field in the late 70s, cancer was just coming out of the closet. But the history is so fascinating because it was actually a strategic thing to make it more into a public issue. There was a push to obtain public support to develop new therapies and so that we could cure cancer. And that was the War on Cancer, 1971, that act that was passed and signed by President Nixon. So in the late 60s and early 70s, there was a large push to inform the public. And from then on, I think that cancer became very different. It became a household thing almost for people. It was no longer taboo.
So we're talking about cancer a lot more openly than we used to, but there's still a lot we don't know. Where are the dark corners of our understanding about cancer?
Well, I think that with a disease, with a process perhaps of this complexity, there's lots we don't know and lots of challenges. The first real issue, I think, is what I call risk assessment. Who is at risk? And how do we quantify that? And then how do we inform people of that? And how do we counsel them? I'd say another challenge is what you mentioned at the beginning of this current discussion. how do we inform and how do we guide and support family members and other people and families about their loved ones' cancers, and how do we help people who have been treated successfully? I think those are. I think that's a dark corner in a way. I think we've not been effective there, and we don't understand how to even intervene and to provide care to an increasing number of cancer survivors, and how do we manage the side effects, the long-term side effects from the cancer.
So we've been talking about finding a cure for cancer for many years, but while science has gotten closer to a more refined understanding of cancer, we still haven't broken through to a solution. Do you think we will ever find a cure?
Some cancers we cure now, and we cure them very well. I think that there'll be a lot of them that we will identify that aren't of great risk, even if you have them. And there'll be others that we're going to cure with the newer approaches of finding out, understanding the heterogeneity biologically, and then fixing those biological problems. And there'll be some that we're able to cure and be able to cure with current cytotoxic approaches and hormonal approaches. So again, the single cure is not something that we can really talk about. What we can talk about is a very huge number of problems. I mean, thousands, millions maybe of different types of cancers where we are able to individualize and able to obtain solutions to the great majority of them. And I think that's the future.
Dr. Dean Brenner is the Cucci Family Professor of Internal Medicine and Professor of Pharmacology at the University of Michigan Medical School. He's also an oncologist on the staff of the VA Medical Center in Ann Arbor. Dr. Brenner, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me.
We can't alter our DNA or change the composition of our cells. That's why it's so tempting to turn to the environment for answers. We can control some of the things we're exposed to, though the connection between cancer and the environment is not always clear. But cancer leaves clues. If a lot of people in one place start getting sick, it might be caused by something in the environment, something they're all exposed to. The term cancer cluster describes a place like that, a place where more people have cancer than you would expect. But finding out if a cluster really exists and then getting something done about it is tough. Reporter Sarah Alvarez visited one town in Michigan that's trying to figure that out.
Claire Schlaff doesn't know if there's a cancer cluster in her small resort community around White Lake, Michigan. She says she just wanted to know more about what might have caused her son, Doug, to get cancer and die 3 years ago.
He went to two major medical facilities, and he was even in a clinical trial. You know, they were focused on his treatment. They weren't about doing research into what causes Ewing sarcoma.
Claire's daughter-in-law, Polly, was also looking for answers to what had caused the disease. She's Doug's widow and the mother of his three boys.
He was diagnosed when he was 33, and he passed away at 35. We were high school sweethearts. He was a high school counselor. He was a high school basketball coach. He was an athlete.
Polly and Claire had a hunch that there was more cancer around White Lake than in other places, so they started a Facebook group called Cancer in White Lake. They collected more than 100 stories from people with all types of different cancers. Claire thought it might have something to do with past pollution.
In 1985, we were listed as one of the Great Lakes areas of concern because of contamination from Hooker Chemical, the tannery, DuPont, and maybe some others.
White Lake has been cleaned up. It's expected to come off the list of polluted places this year. The local health department doesn't have any data to show there's more cancer around White Lake than any place else. But Claire and Polly and some dedicated volunteers want to get the health department more data. The state keeps track of cancer rates by county, but not by town. And there are lots of types of cancers that they don't keep track of at all. So Claire and Polly turn their Facebook group into something else.
It's a voluntary, self-reporting mapping project.
They're trying to map all the people in their community who've had cancer in hope of getting their health department interested in looking into it. They're finding, then calling, and surveying about 1,000 people. Terry Nordbrock runs the nonprofit National Disease Cluster Alliance.
there's hundreds and hundreds of times where people have a concern, they're observing, you know, harmful effects in their community, and they can't get anybody to listen to them. So that is actually the more common outcome, is massive frustration for all involved.
Claire Schlaff says she doesn't expect answers about what caused her son's cancer. She does hope her work is useful and can provide answers for somebody someday.
We'll hear more from Sarah in a little while. The state of Michigan has confirmed a cancer cluster in St. Clair County. Since 2007, 8 young children and a possible 9th have been diagnosed with a rare kidney cancer called Wilms tumor. Danielle Williams' daughter, Erica, was the first to be diagnosed. She was 7 years old.
My daughter was playing soccer, and she came home that night, and we noticed that she had a protruding lump on the side of her belly. And to the touch, it was hot.
An ultrasound revealed what looked like a 6-inch mass in Erica's kidney. Erica had surgery to remove her left kidney, and that's when the doctors discovered the tumor was the size of a football.
In the hospital, she quit. She didn't speak. She didn't really know what was going on, but she knew it was serious because they're so little. You know, they don't know the serious of it. But her seeing me so broken, she never sat there in silence all the time, didn't talk.
Danielle says after Erica's surgery, she went through radiation and a year of chemotherapy. Erica is in remission now. Officials with the Centers for Disease Control say more than 90% of kids diagnosed with Wilms tumor survive. A few months after Erica's diagnosis, another child in the county was diagnosed with Wilms tumor. And then more kids got sick. The youngest was a 6-month-old baby girl.
If children are getting cancer, you know there's something wrong. There's something wrong.
Danielle lives in Marine City on the St. Clair River. It's downstream from Sarnia, Ontario. That area is nicknamed Chemical Valley because of the complex of petrochemical plants on the river. There have been hundreds of spills in the past 2 decades. Several cities, including Marine City, pull their drinking water from the river. Danielle suspects something in the water or the air is making the kids sick. But health officials say right now there is no clear connection between any environmental factor and Wilms tumor. Tom Sinks is with the CDC's National Center for Environmental Health. He says it's believed Wilms tumor could stem from something that happens before a baby is born.
So if you translate that into doing an epidemiologic study, you have to try to recreate what environmental exposures or what the conditions may have been for the mother during pregnancy or possibly before pregnancy.
The St. Clair County Health Department has been following the Wilms cases for a few years. Dr. Annette Mercatant is the medical health officer with the health department. They've given the families in the cancer cluster a detailed survey.
You know, where did they live? What did they eat? Their medical history, their work exposure history. We're just going to be trying to be very comprehensive.
They're also going to try to track down the placentas of the children. Hospitals often save placentas when babies are born. There's a research team at the University of Michigan that's hoping to study the placental tissue to see if they can find any clues about the Wilms tumor cluster. Dr. Mercatant says it will be difficult to figure out why these kids are getting sick.
I need to be honest. And the honest answer is we don't know, and we very well may not know for a long time to come, if ever, especially in something as rare as this.
But she says this cluster of children with cancer deserves a very close look. Fourteen months after they were married, Amy Scott's husband, Joe White, was diagnosed with esophageal cancer. Doctors tried to treat it, but nothing worked.
When they say you have cancer, or in our case, you have terminal cancer, and you only have about a year, all of these things that you would, that bog you down in life, those are suddenly gone. And that's what the gift of cancer is. It's complete release from obligations that are a part of life that when you live a long life, you have to obey. But when you have a very short life, it's freedom. We decided to cash in our 401ks and hit the road. That's what we did. We took all of our money and blew it. We spent all of it. If there was a quarter in the couch, we bought something. I was excited to be on this adventure. This being a part of something so wholly intimate is saying goodbye to everybody. And I feel that being at the end of somebody's life is just as rich an intimate experience as being there when somebody's life begins.
Amy kept a journal that year. Now, in it, she calls her husband by his full name, Joe White. She uses it kind of like a nickname.
April 28th, 2009. Last night, I booked our flights for Joe White and I to take our trip to Northern California, Oregon, and Washington State. After consulting the Atlas, I'm feeling much more relaxed. Joe White, however, is feeling a little tense because knowing how I vacation, he knows my theories. Vacations are for seeing as much as possible. Vacations often need recovery time. June 8th. Last week was New York City, and we squished in what seemed like 400 miles of walking, and we saw a lot of important things, even if from the outside. We did do the handsome cab ride through Central Park. I recommend it for a break from all of the walking. December 17th. We got the results of Joe White's CT scan yesterday, and the cancer is stable. No growth, no shrink. May 11th, 2010. We checked into Cedar Point's wheelchair policy because nothing gets between Joe White and a roller coaster. June 5th. Joe White is in very poor health. Chemo, at this point, would be worse than a waste of time. Here we are, caught in this time between what was and what will be, a something we didn't want to deal with until the two ladies from hospice came and handed us a crap ton of pamphlets and booklets and all other kinds of lets, and there we were, smacked in the face with what we often pretended wasn't there. What Joe wanted was to ride in the cockpit of an airplane and be a part of everything great. What he gets is an overwhelming outpouring of love and attention and concern. May 27th. So, when we arrived at our swanky gated hotel, the first news I was greeted with was, "You've been upgraded to the presidential suite." I didn't have to make a single doctor appointment or worry about hemoglobin counts or if Joe White needs another transfusion. We didn't think about that for 4 days in a row. The kids were in complete amazement the entire time. Up until this point, the fanciest place we've ever taken them is the Holiday Inn, and they were in awe. We ate all of our meals together, we went night swimming together, and at the end of the day, we were exhausted together. When the girls get out of school, we're headed up to the UP for some quality time with the lake and the mosquitoes. Right now, life is being good to us. July 4th. Joe White passed away. We didn't make it to the UP that last time. Really, we knew he was too sick to go, but that was okay. We had another adventure in the works. He was 38, and I was 33.
That was Amy Scott talking about her husband, Joe White. Coming up, stopping cancer before it starts.
What we are trying to do is look at those individuals that we know have an increased risk of developing cancer and intervene with those people before they already have cancer.
That story in 15 minutes on Living with Cancer from Michigan Radio.